is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Outloud. Well, I'm calling this the Great Divide. It's the entire establishment versus we the people, the American people, that is, right? You know, we've been under this belief system, might even be false pretenses at this point, that the president of the United States is the most powerful person in the world, surely the free world, right? But is that really the case? And I've been thinking about that these past many days. And then another question I pose to you, is President Trump being pushed out of office against the will of the American people? Now, the numbers tell a story. I mean, we don't really need to hyperventilate with all kinds of mistruths and misinformation. You just look at the facts and the data, and they tell a pretty incredible story. You're going to find that out today, I promise you that, on Viewpoint This Sunday. We'll start here with Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh is an author. He's a filmmaker. He's a storyteller of truth, I always say, but mostly Dinesh is not only an American patriot, but I believe one of the best conservative voices in our great nation. So I could think of nobody else to go to get this point across today than Dinesh. And let me start here. When you start to look deep into this whole election, just before Election Day, we had, oh my golly, about 60,000 Trump supporters showed up at the president just the last couple of days there in Pennsylvania. We had Trump tractor parades, boat parades, 30-mile-long caravans. There were all kinds of things going on throughout the country. The momentum factor was off the charts, probably something I never recalled seeing from any political race in my lifetime, surely. But I would say at this point, the numbers tell a different story. Let me bounce some numbers by you, and let's just go back and forth here a minute. So here's where we start. President Trump had 52% approval on Election Day and ended up winning 10 million more votes than during his first election. President Trump, in fact, shattered the record for most votes received by a sitting president had never happened before, not since President Grover Cleveland's reelection campaign in 1888 has a sitting president won more votes the second time around and still lost. And by the way, President Obama, the former president, lost 5 million votes between 08 and 2012. And in fact, Obama, Bush, W, Ronald Reagan all won re-election, even though only about 45% of the country felt better off when their presidencies had begun. All that is a bit of a telltale sign, Dinesh, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that we can look at these various indicators that point to the fact that something is deeply wrong here. I'll add one to the mix, and that is that Republicans appear to have gained already 12 seats in the House. Not a single Republican incumbent has lost. So think about that. That means that the support is not just for Trump alone, it's for the party in general. And Trump is more popular than the party. In other words, Trump runs ahead of these Republican candidates. He is, in some senses, the one that's dragging them to victory. So isn't it paradoxical and deeply strange that the Republicans would hold and the Republicans would win and Trump would lose? I understand that in Pennsylvania, through Election Day, all the way through election night, Trump was leading the Republican vote by about 7%, meaning he was doing better than other Republicans on the ticket. And then in the post-counting, the other Republicans held firm, they held the pattern, but Trump took a nosedive, as if to say that suddenly voters decided, we're going to vote Republican down the ticket, but we're going to go for Biden over Trump. I mean, think how ridiculous that is.
Well, all these numbers are ridiculous. 50 6% of voters felt they were better off since the president had entered office. And we all remember those numbers because they were touted quite a bit before the election. Trump had majority approval, as you're just saying, Dinesh, and nearly 6 in 10 Americans felt better off today than when Barack Obama was in office. And yet still this happened. Now, no sitting president has lost re-election when more than half of the country is doing better. It's never happened before in the history of our country that, you know, that the country is doing better before the incumbent entered office. And for Biden to have won the election, despite nearly 6 in 10 Americans doing well under the current president, I mean, this has simply never happened before. And then we talk about the enthusiasm gap, Dinesh. We're talking a 30% enthusiasm gap between Trump and Biden, which, you know, stands to reason when you're running your campaign from a basement in Wilmington. I mean, there was no enthusiasm there at all. So, Dinesh, all the indicators were headed that way, and yet it didn't happen, did it?
Well, in fairness, we should say that this has not been a normal year. This has been a COVID year. So nothing, in a sense, has gone according to pattern. There was a roaring Trump economy early this year. And I think had that economy persisted, this election would not even have been close. Biden clearly gained. The Democrats gained because of COVID. They were able to exploit the fear of COVID. They were able to say, well, listen, Trump is responsible for this carnage. Obviously, the economy is not the same as it was in March of this year. So I think those are obviously factors that need to be taken into account. But even so, with a candidate as ridiculous as Biden huddled in his basement, I mean, looking back on it, to me, it's almost eerie. It's almost as if he knew he didn't need to campaign because the election was somehow in the bag for him. I also think back to all the Democrats pressing Amy Coney Barrett to swear up front that she would recuse herself from any election-oriented cases. Again, it's almost as if the Democrats anticipated that there was going to be litigation over voting systems, over fraud, and they wanted to knock out Amy Coney Barrett as a potential conservative vote in that adjudication.
Yeah, and we see why the fear factor was, why they were pleading with the other side of the aisle to not proceed with that vote for Amy Coney Barrett, Dinesh. They wanted that after the election, and they got pretty aggressive in their talk to that, and we see exactly why now. And as you say, the picture we paint, it's almost like they could see the future. It's almost like the establishment. Well, I've been looking a lot at this establishment in past days, and you just see the constant headlines that are coming across and the way people are positioning. When I talk about the entire establishment, one of the things I've noticed is they're all piling on right now sort of as an insurance policy to make sure that Trump is going. Now, one thing everybody is still a little, and I want you to talk about this a moment, because there's something here we're not talking about. I mean, everybody knows who President Trump is. He is a fighter. And they're waiting for that other shoe to drop. Now, he was very, very, he's been very eerily quiet as all this is happening in the background. He had that brief appearance in the Rose Garden on Friday on the COVID deal. Didn't take any questions, rightfully so. But I find that's interesting. But I think people are waiting to see what Trump has or where he's going. Now, first of all, what do you think about that? And then let's dive into a little bit about these Dominion machines that are going on. You're hearing a lot about this. I don't know what, I haven't talked to you about it yet, but the hammer and scorecard, I'd like to get your thoughts on all of that as well, or where the casualties of this election are. What do you think about this pile on right now?
Well, I've been trying to glean some information about it from Sidney Powell, who is, of course, General Flynn's attorney, now working on the Trump team, really one of the most distinguished attorneys in the country and not in any sense an extremist or a kook. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about episodic cases of improper votes, dead people voting. It's another thing to talk about statistical improbabilities, and there are many of those. I mean, what is the chance, for example, of like 138,000 consecutive votes for Biden? I mean, to me, statistically, the chance of that is precisely zero. So there's all this nonsense going on, and all of this is important, but nothing is more important than if you can show in some way that the machines were altered, of the machines were programmed to switch votes from one side to another. That would be the mother load. I mean, quite honestly, that would blow the lid off the whole election. It would expose not only the Democrats, but the media, because this would be huge. So I'm just watching it skeptically, but nevertheless with great interest to see what exactly the Trump team is onto. They seem to think they're onto something big, mm-hmm. and we're going to have to wait and see.
You know, last week on this program right here, we had Lieutenant General Tom McInerney speaking about a software deal would be a widespread fraud deal. Number one, is it possible? I, like you, have been really looking at it with open eyes. Is this really possible? Because we're talking about something that would have grave consequences here. That would be blowing the lid off, as you just said, but that would expose everything to national. That would be a moment in our history, actually, that would almost be a line from the establishment to the people. Do you think this is really possible with what, I mean, I know we don't know all the facts at this point, but in the big question I have, which I imagine you have, is it provable? What do you think?
Possible for sure. I would even inch toward probable. Now, look, I would not say that 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, I had a lot of confidence in some of our basic institutions. I knew that the media was biased, but I didn't think that they would not cover the biggest story of the election, in this case, the Biden scandal. I knew that we had police agencies of government, but I didn't think that they would conspire against a legitimately elected president in 2016 to overthrow him. Moreover, I didn't realize that that kind of an order to do that would come from the president of the United States, Barack Obama. All of this is now true. We know it with virtual certainty. So how can we say, when we've discovered that these institutions have been corrupted from the top, they do all kinds of shenanigans, they set people up, to think now that they would come, that there would be some sort of a organized plan. Remember, the left calls it a conspiracy theory, but all organized criminal activity is a conspiracy. So conspiracies do exist. And just because you label something a conspiracy theory, proof says nothing about whether it's true or false. So is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? I'm not sure. Is it provable? We're going to wait and see.
Yeah, that is for certain, boy. Wow. I don't know. There's a lot to question there, for sure, if this is going to see the light of day or not, with all of this happening. The one thing about it, Dinesh, with the establishment piling on here. Now, as you just stated, this was a full-on pile-on, including the media, including the pollsters, all of these naysayers. But this had been building for some time. You know, I often reference back to last November. And the reason I talk about last November, because that was before the handy-dandy virus came in from China, if you will. And that's when the economy and everything was just in the stratosphere. And I think the left, and I would say to you, Dinesh, they were looking at each other saying, what the hell are we going to do? How are we going to get this guy out of here? My golly, we've tried everything. We've done it by hook and by crook. And we've done, I mean, we've even the way to a faux impeachment. I mean, what more could we do with this guy? It's like he says they couldn't shake Trump no matter what they did. How does, with this pylon of all the levels, the atrocities we're talking about, if this is real, versus, okay, they're just trying because they didn't win. How can they, I don't see how it's possible they can keep this all quiet and under wraps. I mean, you can't have a widespread fraud, scandal, establishment takeover like this without it being revealed at some point. I don't see how that's possible. Having said that, every hour that goes by is getting closer to, first of all, the Electoral College on the 14th of December and January, ultimately on the 20th. Can they hide it in the long term?
The only way that they can hide it, assuming it's true, is with our consent, with our complicity. And in the past, they have always relied on the conservatives and the Republicans to be the party of the wimps and the namby-pambies and the party of the people who shrug their shoulders and go into a defeatist posture and say, let's move on. So they count on that. And the reason for this drumbeat is to produce that predictable result. So think about it this way. Before the election, why were the polls showing these preposterous leads for Biden. Biden 17 points ahead, you know, in Wisconsin. I mean, it's laughable, but they were doing it to create an aura of inevitability. Like the guy may look like a fool, but he's going to win anyway. And similarly now, they're trying to create the sense, well, Biden's already president. Look, he's got a sign, Office of the President-elect. He's naming his staff. He's talking to foreign leaders. So the sense of inevitability is to say to the Republicans, listen, you people, you know, be the normal cowards that we count on you to be and give in. But the bad news for them is the Republican Party is not doing that. It's not giving in. It's actually not listening to them at all. And this gives the Trump people some time to be able to produce the evidence and drop it and move it up the court and get it to the Supreme Court and at least get a, what I hope will be, a fair hearing of it. And then we let the court decide. The court, I think, recognizes the stakes. They know how important it is to preserve the integrity of our democracy. They know how bad it is to have voter shenanigans that if they're allowed to continue, would continue in the next election and beyond. So that's our system. And I guess I still have some residual faith in that to produce a fair result.
Amen to that. But yet then people are telling me with the result you throw out there right now, which people are thinking exactly what you're saying. But then they say on the other side of that, Dinesh, then they say, well, what will happen, though, is there'll be major unrest and there'll be wars and people will be like livid that Trump is going to hang around. And then I say back, well, what would you rather have? A little unrest right now and a little mini confrontations or whatever they're going to be versus turning this over to a Marxist regime and taking on a new direction.
It's not even that. It's not even that. If there's civil unrest, we are basically back into the year 1860 when Abraham Lincoln won a close but nevertheless legitimate election. The other side tried all kinds of shenanigans. Now, they were different types of shenanigans than we see now, but nevertheless, it was a gangsterized Democratic Party trying by hook or by crook to unseat Lincoln and then refusing to accept the result of the election. Wow. You know, we're right back there again. But you don't get to undo democracy just by going into the street. So go into the street all you wish, but it's not going to do any good. So I would say we should brace ourselves. Let's look for a fair result. We're not, by the way, this is not a case where we can't accept losing, not at all. We accepted losing the midterm in 2018. We accepted losing two terms to Obama. We didn't say that the vote was rigged. There probably was some voter fraud in those cases too, but not enough to make a difference. Obama did win twice. But this time we're convinced that Biden did not win. And our recalcitrance, our stubbornness is all based on that.
One of the things I want to comment on you about Trump's impact, first of all, on the GOP, the grand old party here. One of the historical points of this election that has been certainly undertowed because nobody's talking about these points of interest here is that Trump won a greater share of minority votes than any Republican presidential candidate since 1960 and brought more Democrats over to his side than in 2016, which really was the whole picture of this thing. Was he going to be able to get those votes from the minority? And, you know, in Dinesh, to your point a moment ago here, I tell people all the time, I explain to listeners all the time, the right always acquiesces to the left. That is always a do-si-do is what it is, as they do that. They've been doing that through the history. You go back to 1860, it's a perfect example. This thing's been going on. We're looking at about 150 years now, at least plus, plus, plus. So it's not really a new event, but Trump is the one thing that seems to be a potential firewall to the corrupt establishment. But how much of an impact was it to you with the minority vote and what the president was able to accomplish with the grand old party, which, by the way, finally, we're getting something straight here, Dinesh, because this was never supposed to really be the party of the old white man business. And the Democrats branded the right that way, but they were indeed for the elite, and they were indeed what they were projecting, which is what they do well. What do you think about that accomplishment?
Well, Trump has changed the GOP in two significant ways. One is he has shifted the emphasis of the GOP from a sort of party of business, including big business, to now a party of small entrepreneurs and working class Americans, white, black, and Latino. And the effect of this has been to draw more minorities into the party and make the Republican Party more of a middle class party. This, I think, is very good for the long-term prospects of the GOP. Second, I think that Trump has toughened the spine of the Republican Party. Just about every Republican right now, not only would they have withdrawn from the race in 2016 if they had had the kind of scandals that Trump did, but I think right now, if it was any Republican other than Trump, they would already have conceded this race. Right. Not because they're marvelous gentlemen that we should admire, but because they don't have the backbone to withstand the kind of withering attack that comes from the media. Now, I think the good thing that Trump is teaching us is to reduce the power of the media in our minds. That the media, in a sense, has us captive only because it lives inside our head. Mm-hmm. And if we give less importance to these guys, we don't even feel like we should react to them. Ah, we saw this on CNN. Who cares? So we've got to be a little more cool-headed about all this. And I think Trump has set a pretty good example in this regard.
Now, the left is coming after the right pretty aggressively right now. You've heard of this, or have you, the Trump Accountability Project. This is their website here, and this is the headline on their site. It says, "Remember what they did. We must never forget those who furthered the Trump agenda." And then you're hearing reports of hit lists that leftist leaders are placing Trump supporters on. What do you make of all this?
Well, it's really, first of all, I think it's a little bit laughable. But second of all, I think that this really shows the tyrannical mindset of the left. Because when they say things, and some of them, Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post says, you know, we've got to burn down the Republican Party. Now, I mean, you know, here you've got this ridiculous hag, you know, burn down the Republican Party. It's not going to happen. But the more important thing is that that's their psychology. What does that mean? If you want to burn down the opposition party, that means you want to live in a one-party state. Now, that is pure Leninism. You know, when Lenin came to power, he goes, the working class are not going to revolt. We sort of have to do it for them. We need to have this cadre of revolutionaries that takes power. And then we create a one-party state. So, you know, unbelievably, that kind of tyrannical mentality, which we think of in terms of foreign countries and people with Cossack uniforms and toothbrush mustaches, you know, we have that in this country now, coming from these strange, weird people who apparently have a Leninist streak in their bodies.
Yeah, we'll see, you know, how much they push the right. But I think a lot of people are fearful for these threats that are being made from the left, for sure. Did you also see the comments by chance from Justice Samuel Alito, which was wanted to get your thoughts on? He says the COVID restrictions highlight disturbing trends of lawmaking by executive fiat. Now, this has all come out. He was speaking to the Federalist Society. And this is after now we're hearing the first thing that Biden wants to do is a national lockdown. His chief of staff, I think, said for 6 weeks they're trying to get the country to have a lockdown, like everybody lock up again, including the dog park in your local communities. And so, you know, and then national mask mandates and all this. And so Justice Alito, very uncharacteristic for a justice to come out like this and speak. And it was a hell of a speech, actually. Did you catch some of that? And what do you think of it?
I did. I think it's an important message. And I'm hoping that the Supreme Court isn't going to rely on a speech to the Federalist Society to be an articulation. I mean, the court is entrusted with the protection of these basic liberties. So think about something like the right to religious liberty or the right to free speech. Who's the custodian of that right? The court. And who does the court have to protect that right against? The majority. And so the bottom line of it is I would like to see the Supreme Court actively strike down left and right all these restrictions that are passed. Remember, the court does not have to say, who cares if a legislature passed it? Who cares if Biden issues this as a mandate? Neither of them get to override the Constitution. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. So it's one thing to give a speech to the Federalist Society, but I would say there's now a Supreme Court majority. Let's round up the gang and start striking down these laws. Boom, boom, boom.
when the Supreme, what you say right there is perfect. But with the Supreme Court, again, really being, we've seen the transition of that court in past days. It really has become more of a political branch of our federal government with all these federal appointees. I mean, where they are appointed from the left and the right. And we see how they vote with a lot of their votes that don't really back up the Constitution. Obviously, with these three new appointees that Trump has done, there's maybe a breath of fresh air that's been put into the court. But you still have confidence in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think that we finally have, with Amy Coney Barrett, a clear 5-4 majority. We really have a 6-3 conservative court, but Roberts is a little bit unreliable, so we don't want to have to count on him. He's a little bit of the sort of Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski type that you can't really count on entirely. But we can count on the others, and that we got five of them. So the point about it is, you know, the three Democrats are hopeless, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, but no big deal. We have five solid protectors of basic liberties, and they need to get to work.
Okay. Last question, last point to you, Dinesh, is this, and this is important. You know, we've seen the fight in President Trump, America has. They've seen that he is a fighter, as we've just suggested on this program, in fact, that he is a different kind of, well, you don't even want to say the word Republican, but he's a different kind of conservative. He's a different kind of patriot. For many, he is a firewall to a country that many don't want to see. It was a very telltale sign in the Rose Garden on Friday when he had the speech with COVID and some of the speakers there. And there was he looked, many would suggest, a little uncomfortable. This was the first time he was addressing the nation since the grand steal on the 3rd of November. And the president says, and I quote here, "This administration will not be going to a lockdown. Hopefully the whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be. I guess time will tell." Now, I got a lot out of that, and his mannerisms and the way he was approaching that told me he recognizes at that moment what you and I just talked about, Dinesh D'Souza, in regards to the establishment. What I got out of that, to a couple of sentences there, as the president, if you read into it, is admitting to the American people he is going against the entire system. He recognizes it now. Back to as I started this program with you, we the people and the full-on assault of the establishment. That was a telltale sign to me where it was a bit of inevitably where he was thinking, not sure if I can pull this off, America, but I'm going to give it a hell of a shot. What do you take of that, please?
I think that is the place at which the fighting spirit does need to come to an end. In other words, we're not going to carry the fighting spirit to leading an armed insurrection. We're carrying the fighting spirit through all legal means to challenge this outcome. And then we're going to accept what the outcome is. I think that is the correct way for us. The left doesn't do it that way. We talked a moment ago about how if we win legally, they might still go nuts. In fact, we expect them to go nuts, but we're not going to go nuts in that way, and neither is President Trump. So I think it's a mark of his decency and patriotism. He is a fighter. But look, let's just say that we don't have the proof. Let's just say that Biden won fair and square. Then the truth of it is Trump cannot save the American people from themselves. If the American people decide, you know what, we've had enough of Trump, we're going to go back to business as usual, that is the Democratic way, and we're going to just have to shrug our shoulders and regroup to take the House and the Senate in the midterm and do better in 2024.
I love what you say there. I love what you say. We can't keep the American people from themselves. I mean, they have to make that decision. That really is the ultimate. And I basically have shared those same sentiments in past days and weeks here, as far as if this was the will of the American people, then it so should be. But if it was not, then it should not be. The place I might differ slightly is that we should not acquiesce under any condition. If we know the will was opposite, then I think it is time for some sort of a moment in our nation's history. And I think there's some strong words there. And I don't know quite all what that means, but, you know, how much do we take at this point before patriots and God-loving Americans stand up for truth and justice and liberty?
Wow. Well, I mean, certainly if there is irrefutable evidence that there was widespread fraud and the Supreme Court goes, oh, ho-hum, it's none of our business. You know, this is something that we are not going to get involved in. That would be a whole different situation, because then the Supreme Court would be sort of in the Dred Scott mode, where they would be making an outrageous decision that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. They're basically essentially winking while you have a rigged voting system. So we'd have to take stock of what that all means. But I think we'll get to that pass if and when, and hopefully never, we come to it.
That's it. I ask each of you to take this information that we just talked about with Dinesh, and when this does go to podcast later in the day here, be sure to replay it for yourself and listen to the words again. Listen to what was said, because we just talked about quite a bit here and the way we want to address this as a nation, as a people. And what I like mostly is that we need to stand and have class and dignity, but truth always, because liberty must prevail. It must be, at the end of the day, what we stand for. Tremendous, tremendous thank you always to Dinesh D'Souza. And now we move on, my fellow Americans. Dr. Elizabeth Lee-Vliet, Dr. Brooke Pletner, more on the COVID stuff. But more than that, the fatal errors that were made and the unimaginable restrictions on our individual liberty and much, much more on Viewpoint. We'll rejoin you just after the pause.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio. Well, we each know that 2020 is beyond just a memorable year. It is going to be a year of landmark changes for our nation, for so many reasons, as you know. And, you know, one of the fear factors, again, that are playing into the news cycle is the COVID. You're seeing the resurface of a lot of information, and a lot of it is dire, and a lot of it is meant to create fear. And it's really troublesome to me personally that that is a drumbeat and a narrative that is consistently put out there. And you have to look under the radar to understand why that is going on in the way that it is. There are some real answers to COVID as well that we will talk about in this segment. So you want to pay attention to that, because we will get to a point where there is a lot of hope here. And we've been talking about this for some time. I'm going to reveal some of that now, as well as some very interesting comments from Supreme Court Justice Alito, as well as our individual liberty, of course. Not that that's any big deal today, right? So let's do that. And joining me now on the program is Dr. Elizabeth Lee-Vliet. She is an independent physician specializing in preventive and climacteric medicine. She's a great voice out there, really working with some big voices to try to make that difference in our nation for the COVID challenges that we've had. Also joining me is Dr. Baruch Plettner is here. Dr. Baruch is a scientist. He's a historian, writer, and host of Choose to Be Free here on America Out Loud. Takes a look at some of the political issues out there and societal issues in a very different way. And so I look forward to this next conversation here. So the drumbeat has started here now, as we now have the political camps set up here, Dr. Vliet, and we have the, they're calling him, of course, Biden. We still have that not totally decided, but they're calling him president-elect. That's all to be decided ahead. We'll probably end up in the Supreme Court, as we were just talking to Dinesh on top of the show about that. But I think one of the things we're seeing now is there's a lot of claims that cases are rising. And I'm noticing a lot of stress within the fact, like I see the headline yesterday, Wall Street Journal reports U.S. cases top 180,000 for the first time. And I've been seeing this over the past couple of weeks with these kind of headlines that seem dire. But I guess what I think about right back, and they typically don't impact me myself, because I think back, don't we need to have the rise in cases? I mean, isn't that part of always what was going to happen? But it's really how we deal with those cases and how we deal with the hospitalizations and how we deal with these things, I think, that we've been talking about. Tell us how we should be looking at this news cycle that's burning a hole right now.
Well, Malcolm, I think it's clear that the convergence of flu and COVID moving into the winter season, we do expect that there will be more hospitalizations and more people getting sick. And there is a hopeful message that early treatment works for the flu, which most people know, and it works well in COVID. It's just not been a policy of the federal government under the leadership of Dr. Fauci to focus on early home-based treatment, which I know we'll talk more about.
For instance, Joe Biden, he says, and he has said even before the campaign, he said it's going to be a dark winter. That was his, and that was kind of touted out there a little bit to be a real, you know, a pessimistic look at America. And you know, we always knew the convergence of flu season, which can be very deadly, and COVID could be some real possibilities. But now they're talking, Dr. Vliet, about having another, I mean, there's talk there with his new chief of staff that he's appointed of a 6-week national lockdown mandatory. They're also talking about mask mandates, lockdowns. I mean, there's some pretty extreme things, and not to mention Governor Newsom in California, and you've got Cuomo in New York, and a host of others that are taking some pretty serious steps now with removing people's rights. How does all that play into this?
Well, that actually is the whole point. The lockdowns and mask mandates and social distancing simply have not controlled the virus. We wouldn't expect it to. That is only one of four approaches in the management of any infectious disease. Therefore, contagion control, which we just talked about, early home treatment, which right, we do in every other disease in medicine, including seasonal flu, and late treatment, which is all that's been offered. In the U.S., I mean, the NIH guidelines say no treatment at all until you need oxygen and need to be in the hospital. That's absurd. We don't do that with any other illness. Certainly, you wouldn't tell a cancer patient, go home and wait until stage four to be come into the hospital and try to treat you to save your life. And the fourth approach is always prevention, which gets into prophylaxis, herd immunity, and vaccination. And all we have heard about is wait for a vaccine. You either shut everything down under pillar one, contagion control, or you wait until you're ready to, you're critically ill and go to the hospital, or wait for a vaccine. There has been a national total oblivion in approach to early home-based treatment with existing medicines. Basically, Malcolm, this virus has three elements: the virus, inflammation, and blood clots. Doctors treat all of those every single day. We have medicines in the United States we've used my entire medical career: antivirals, anti-inflammatories like corticosteroids, and anticoagulants to prevent blood clots. We know how to do that. I've treated lots of patients at home early, and they get well, and they haven't gone into the hospital. T to ignore this is unconscionable. And in fact, if it were cancer and we doctors were ignoring early treatment, we would be sued for malpractice.
You take right now, they're talking about closing schools again. They're talking about closing the whole economic system down again. They're talking about, there are gyms and restaurants and salons and other businesses that, they've been hit so hard. In some cases, many of these cities, up to 60, 70% of businesses will never come back again. I mean, we're talking things that it's beyond anything. And we haven't really, what's really amazing is that we've been able to bounce back economically as we've done, which tells you the might of the American people. But we should never take that for granted. Under the conditions of the losses, so many people are going to suffer, which I don't think we fully have comprehended yet or suffered the consequences of yet. So I want to play an audio clip here. Listen to this here from Justice Samuel Alito. He was speaking at the Federalist Society here.
The pandemic has obviously taken a heavy human toll. Thousands dead, many more hospitalized, millions unemployed, the dreams of many small business owners dashed. But what has it meant for the rule of law? I'm now going to say something that I hope will not be twisted or misunderstood, but I have spent more than 20 years in Washington, so I'm not overly optimistic. In any event, here goes. The pandemic has resulted in previously unimaginable restrictions on individual liberty. We have never before seen restrictions as severe, extensive, and prolonged as those experienced for most of 2020.
What do you say about that, Brooke, when he says unimaginable restrictions on individual liberty, and you hear the initial talk we're having with Dr. Blee, your thoughts?
I mean, the first thing that occurs to me when I hear that is from a historical perspective, the world has always been divided into kind of East and West. And in the East, there is really no concept of individual liberty or even individual rights. In other words, the rights of the individual are completely subjugated to the rights of the collective. The individual in China, Russia, India, even, you name it, the individual does not exist as an individual. The individual exists only as part of the collective, and it's only the good of the collective that means anything. And what the Constitution has said as the kind of the crowning document of the Western civilization, starting from Athens, Rome, and through Northern Germany, England, and the Enlightenment, when the Constitution basically says is that the collective has no rights. It's the diametric opposite. The Constitution in its original form does not recognize the rights of classes, of classes based on anything, based on color, based on sexual orientation, anything else. The Constitution recognizes only the rights of the individual. And the rights of the individual are supreme because they're given by the Creator, by God. And the only job that the government really has is safeguarding those God-given rights of the individual and only of the individual. So what Alito is saying in a more kind of circumspect and polite and legal way than I ever could or even care to is that what happened in America now is utterly un-American and utterly unconstitutional. Because what America is doing now is what China would be doing, is what Russia is doing, is what European countries are doing. It's what countries that have no constitution are doing. And the Constitution in America prohibits, forbids this kind of infringement of on individual liberty, no matter what.
Listen to this. He said, Alito now said, the COVID crisis has served as sort of a constitutional stress test. Boy, that is something else, Brooke, the way he puts that out there in this speech, which I listened to the entire speech. But it really is a constitutional stress test. I mean, listen, we don't always need the betters to tell us what to do in our own lives. I mean, they can suggest, okay, super. It's like, I'll give you an example, Brooke, to be a smart guy here, but let me be a smart guy. I was going into the Costco store the other day with my two teenagers. And as I approached the door, they demanded a mask. mask. Well, we have no mask on us. We're well over that program, well down the boulevard, and we're not doing the mask. And my teenagers felt the same way. And the guy says, well, you can't enter the store. Well, I paid you for a membership. I pay you people so I get the privilege of shopping. So I pay you the membership, and then you want me to pay for the goods. And now you want to throw me the hell out because I got to have a mask on. This is ridiculous. And I said to the guy, and then I just backed off and I said, you know what? You can keep the membership. You can keep the program. You can keep the whole deal. I'm not coming back. Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, what I say is that, yes, I mean, I'm fortunate that I live a little bit in the country and I don't have to wear a mask on a daily basis, but it may yet happen. What we see today is a kind of a confluence of power hungry governments. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, and when I say governments, I mean in America, local, state, federal, they're all hungry for power. They're all grabbing, reaching, right? Mm-hmm. But in addition to all of that in America now, we have something that we didn't used to have before, which is this woke business, right? Suppose Costco is a private company, right? The bank that you have your accounts with, credit cards with, is a private company. The company that maintains the internet connection that we're now talking over is a bunch of different private companies. Okay. And all of them supposedly, right, because they're private, they can say, well, we ask that you take your shoes off, that you put a mask on, that you put a dunce cap on, that whatever, right? Because we're private, so we can do whatever the heck we want to do. Okay, you know what? I'm going to close my account with Costco, and I'm going to go to Sam's Club. Because guess what? Sam's Club is going to be the same as Costco.
Maybe. But right now, we've become reliant on companies like Amazon and companies like Google and all the social media stuff. And so we have become reliant on them. And they what they did is they threw a web out there. They grabbed us all and have encapsulated audience now. And here we're at their mercy, more or less. All right. And let me bring Dr. Vliet back into this interesting part of the conversation here. I really thought of you when because I know how you are about individual liberty. I know how you are about our rights as a physician, but also as a patriot and as someone who respects our Constitution. And, you know, those comments where he, Alito says it's served as sort of a constitutional stress test. He says, you know, we've never before seen restrictions as severe, extensive, or prolonged. I mean, basically, I mean, the American people have to know enough to come out of the rain. Sincerely, Dr. Vliet, I say, you know, we can't be talked to downward and mandated to do all this stuff because we would be no different than what Dr. Brooke Pletner says there a moment ago here. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think that is exactly the type of tyranny that the American colonists rose up against with King George.
Amen.
Although this is far worse. My ancestors were there at that time. I'm descended from people who came in 1608. Mm-hmm. And I have ancestors who fought in the First Revolutionary War because of oppression of religious liberty, financial liberty, the stamp tax, and all of these elements that King George was imposing on the colonists. And they rose up against that and fought for liberty and life, our Creator's gifts. And that is what's critical here. And actually, Malcolm, it was only 3% approximately of the colonists that stood up and rose up and fought for liberty. We're seeing that today. Are you a 3%er? And I would have to say, yes, I am, because I am only here because my ancestors were one of those who fought for liberty.
Yeah. I love your comment about 3%. What a great reminder that is, Dr. Vliet. God, so well said. And I have to believe that Brooke would agree with that. But it brings me back to what we were talking about at the top of the program in regards to with Dinesh, as far as we were at when we spoke about the establishment and what was taking place across our country. It is going to take people who love our Constitution and who respected what the founders put together here in this beautiful American experiment. And again, that 3% club, which really we were founded on the 3% club. We need to further that conversation forward because that is really a good thing to say. And that's really, if those people don't lead the way and the light for liberty, I would suggest to you, Lee, it's not going to happen. Yeah. Let's talk about the early home treatment now and the lockdown. Now, that instead of a national lockdown, instead of forcing people back to what Toledo says and stripping more individual rights off of people, how about we get this right at this point with the early home treatment? And you would say what, please?
Well, I'm very grateful that Senator Johnson has called a hearing before the Senate Oversight Committee on Government Affairs and National Security, because this is that critical. And he understands. I've worked with him very closely since the beginning of April on all of this, trying to break through this narrative that we have to lock everything down and send people home to quarantine until they get so sick they need to be in the hospital or wait for a vaccine. That is simply not the model that's working in other countries. And we can show in the data a 10 to 20 fold greater death rate in the countries that have restricted early treatment at home. And that's the United States, Canada, Australia, UK, Western Europe, primarily countries that are using the antivirals, anti-inflammatory corticosteroids and anticoagulants early in the COVID illness. In the first 5 days of symptoms, there are countries that actually prepare medication kits that public health people are taking out to give to patients in their home to start treatment within the first day or two of symptoms. And when you do that, this virus responds very well. And in particular, this virus is different from the seasonal flu, because in people over 50 or people younger than 50 with comorbidities, and by that it's things like diabetes, obesity, hypertension, kidney disease, lung disease, asthma, immune suppression illnesses, or cancer treatment, for example, people with those other medical conditions over 50 or younger than 50 with them are very high risk for this virus to go into not just the virus damage, but the inflammation and damage from blood clotting that is what's killing so many people by waiting too late. Mm-hmm. And what the data shows, and we've got 171 studies of hydroxychloroquine alone as an antiviral, anti-inflammatory agent that showed a 64% decrease overall in hospitalizations and deaths versus late treatment in the hospital that was only a 26% reduction in death. So we really have the means at our disposal. And that is what Senator Johnson's hearing is about, is to take the peer-reviewed medical studies that Dr. McCullough and his team of experts internationally and across the U.S. put together and published in August in the American Journal of Medicine. And all of this is on your website, Malcolm, mm-hmm. in a blog post I did last week for your audience mm-hmm. that lists all of these resources so people can go there and click on it and see the resources. And then I worked with Dr. McCullough going back to September, and I said, we need a patient guide written, taking your article right. written in layman's language.
There was tremendous work put in that guide. I mean, I know Dr. Vliet worked endlessly over weeks to pull that together. We'll have that all up on the platform at AmericaOutloud.com as you hear this on Sunday now and throughout the week here. I will ask you real quickly, I want to ask you this, Dr. Vliet, in regards to like the average person out there, before you have the symptoms even, so I'm speaking about prophylactically, there are things we could take like zinc and other things. Is it D or E? What are the things you recommend, the 1, 2, 3 that we could all do?
Okay. In healthy people under age 50, mm-hmm. good options for over-the-counter supplements that help reduce your risk of developing a viral illness like COVID or flu
right.
would be increasing vitamin D, vitamin D3, and vitamin C, zinc. And many people are finding that quercetin, for example, can help reduce. It's a zinc ionophore. It gets zinc into the cells, and that can be used. Also, NAC and acetylcysteine can be used. But the more significant prophylactic regimens that India and a number of other countries have used very successfully And Baylor did a study here as well with prophylaxis using hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin as antivirals combined with zinc. And both of those medicines, in fact, hydroxychloroquine given once a week for prophylaxis has clear evidence of reducing the risk of infection dramatically. And many doctors are actually doing that themselves. And it's working very well.
Again, we'll put all those links right on the platform so you can get all the information that Dr. Vliet is speaking about right now. And it is important, but this is certainly a better path and an alternative than what they are suggesting with further lockdowns. Finally, let me bring on here, and let me just get back here to Dr. Brooke Blattner a moment here and get your final thoughts, Brooke, on there's a tall order ahead. I mean, we're seeing this this rift in the nation that we have pointed out very clearly on Viewpoint here. With all of the stuff and the COVID restrictions and the things you've been writing about, and give us a point or a measure of the state of affairs, the state of time, where we're at right now, and do you see any glimpse of optimism you would suggest to us as a people based on this moment we should grab onto?
There are always reasons to remain optimistic. You know, as long as you draw breath, as long as you know, you have something to eat, you have a roof over your head, you're in reasonably good health, you can always remain optimistic. But I would say that, you know, what I would say is that every American, and maybe even people outside of American countries that are supposed to be free, Canada, Western Europe, you know, Israel, so on, everybody should kind of look at their lives, at their surroundings, and say, you know, how much do I value my personal freedom, my personal liberty? Because if I put high value on that, well, then maybe being in a state like Massachusetts is not for me, and I should take my valuable skills, my valuable dollars, my efforts, my energy, and move to Idaho or to North Dakota or to Florida or whatever, you know, climate suits you or wherever you find opportunities. But, you know, America still has a federal structure. America is still a large country in which there are different jurisdictions. There are big cities, smaller towns, countryside, farmland, you name it. And I think that, you know, looking forward, it's important to realize that in many places in America, substantially in the bigger cities and in those, we all know what they are, the cause of individual liberty is lost. And it's lost for generations. Even if you feel, and I feel the same, that President Trump has won this election, you still have to realize that, you know, there are however many people, 70 million or however many, yeah, that voted for Biden, right? That voted for higher taxes, that voted for lockdowns, that voted for a collective, right, for a collectivist way of life, right?
Yes, yes.
And so we know that, and that's half the country, and we know where that half of the country is, and it's not likely that we will be able to convince them, yeah, to change their ways any more than they would convince us to change.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's it. And then if we take the other half and we divide that up, and then you get back to that 3% that Dr. Vliet was talking about moments ago. Anyways, that's where we'll end right there. But think about this, my fellow Americans, and connect the dots back to what Dinesh D'Souza was saying at the front of the program. And then you'll begin to see what we're talking about here. I got to tell you, this has been a very, very revealing today, the data and the information we talked about. Listen, just straight out, there's a reason we are the fastest growing news magazine in the nation right now. And I think you just heard it in the last hour here. I mean, great voices and stuff you're not going to hear anywhere else. And that's the reason we need you to get on board here and help us also continue to get the word out there so that the truth will prevail. And it's most important we do that here. Thank you here to Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet, also Dr. Brooke Blattner, and Dinesh D'Souza here on Viewpoint. For the next hour, Michael Johns will join me in Viewpoint Presents. We'll continue to take a look at all of the top stories here this week here. And as always, I thank you for being with me on the journey. It's time to get involved and get loud.